Welcome back, everyone. We're talking with Graham Hancock about his latest historical novel, War God, about the fascinating story of the Spanish conquest of Mexico, and of course, all the characters involved in this, both historical and created by Graham as well. I wanted to ask you a little bit more about, I guess, the demon as it appeared to both Moctezuma and Cortés, as you suggested. Have you had any kind of similar encounter yourself, a similar experience, and this is kind of what you draw upon, Graham?
Yes, I have. I have done. I think it's no secret that I have been working with the visionary brew of the Amazon, ayahuasca, for 10 years now, and I do feel that ayahuasca is an amazing healing influence, and that by and large its influence and its role in human society is extremely positive. For those who haven't drunk ayahuasca, it is quite an ordeal to drink it. The taste is truly horrible. I won't even begin to describe it, but let's just settle on one of the worst tastes on the planet, together with a really ghastly smell as well. You really have to brace yourself to drink it. Secondly, it makes you vomit, it gives you diarrhea. I've had somewhat more than 50 sessions with ayahuasca now over the last 10 years, and I would say that the physical symptoms have begun to reduce. I don't get so much of the vomiting and diarrhea now, very, very little. But it does put your body through an ordeal, and the shamans in the Amazon say that that is a necessary cleansing process to allow the ayahuasca to do its work. Then the next aspect of ayahuasca, very familiar to any who've drunk it, is best described as a life review. That you get to look at your own life and at the impact you've had on others. And this is where the benign, loving teacher that is believed to be behind the ayahuasca brew becomes clear. We often call her Mother Ayahuasca. That she seems to want you to be the best you can possibly be. And this involves showing you where you've let yourself down with your own behavior and how you need to improve that. And often people will, and I have done so myself, will burst into tears during ayahuasca sessions with the realization that some word or action of theirs caused great pain to others and was needless pain, which they should never have caused. And the end result is that you find yourself wanting to be a more nurturing and a more positive person. It's hard work to integrate that into your life, to integrate those teachings and to change bad habits. But I would say I've observed this in myself and in others over the last decade, that ayahuasca is a school which constantly urges you to be a better person, and specifically to give more love and to be more nurturing to others and less selfish and less of a taker from others. So very healing and positive in that respect. And this is a little bit of a long preamble to the question you asked me, but I need to say this before I come to your point.
Sure, yeah.
It's less well known that ayahuasca has been very effective in getting people off addictions to hard drugs like heroin and cocaine. There's a famous clinic famous for those who know this realm, in Peru called Takiwasi, run by a French doctor, Jacques Mabit, where they have incredible success with getting heroin and cocaine addicts off their habit. Usually by giving them 12 ayahuasca sessions over a period of a month, and more than half of them leave completely free of addiction and never return to the addiction. Now, I was never addicted to heroin or cocaine, but I did have a 24-year, and I would have to call it a kind of addiction, to cannabis. And I don't mean to put cannabis down. When I talk about this, I do feel it's really important to stress this. I think cannabis itself can be a great ally. It has wonderful medicinal properties. It's a beautiful sensual experience often, and it can be very creatively constructive as well. But the problem was not cannabis. The problem was my relationship with cannabis. Over a 24-year period, I became completely dependent upon cannabis. I would smoke it all day from the moment I got up until the moment I went to sleep. I used a vaporizer in the later years. I felt that I couldn't write without it. I organized my trips around the world based on where I could and could not get cannabis. And gradually, as the years went by, it began to have more and more negative effects on me. I mean my relationship with cannabis, not cannabis itself. And this included too much suspicion and mistrust of others, too much jealousy, too much doubt. I was constantly in a state of paranoia. And this affected my behavior negatively towards near and dear ones around me. And from the moment I started drinking ayahuasca, which was in 2003, in the ayahuasca trance, I started to get messages that I needed to do something about this abusive cannabis habit. It was rather odd that I was getting those messages. It was like a teaching, you know, you need to take yourself in hand here and not just smoke this stuff all day long. It's bending you out of shape. But I didn't listen to those messages until a series of five sessions in October of 2011, when I was given a kind of shattering revelation by ayahuasca. And that revelation was so powerful that since that day, I have never smoked cannabis again.
Just like that, huh?
I completely stopped. I tried to smoke it when I came back to England, but after I had taken two or three puffs from my bag of vapor, I was filled with such horror and self-loathing and I felt that I was poised on the edge of an abyss that I literally could not continue. I just could not continue. The matter was taken out of my hands. And actually, for me, again, I don't want to put down others who use cannabis because many people use it responsibly and positively, and it's a very benign influence in their lives. But for me, it had become a negative influence. All my suspicion and jealousy evaporated. That made me much happier and made people around me much happier as well. My fear that I couldn't write turned out to be complete nonsense. I write much more fluently and much more productively now than I did before. And in general, in every way, I feel much better. I feel liberated. I feel like a monkey's been taken off my back. And that came about entirely because of this shattering revelation that I was given a direct encounter with this entity, this powerful, loving entity who, you know, those of us who work regularly with ayahuasca, as I said, there's becoming a tendency to call her Mother Ayahuasca, an association with a sort of mother goddess of this planet. That she showed me that I was on a path that would lead to my doom, and I was shown this in such stark and terrifying terms that it completely changed my behavior. If anybody told me before I went down to Brazil for that series of five sessions that I would never smoke cannabis again, I would have thought I would have just laughed at them because cannabis was so central to my life. But here I am today, not smoking it, and that is as a result of ayahuasca. Plain and simple, very, very clear and definite. A healing has been given to me. And then the other thing that I talked about this in my controversial TED talk,
right?
You know,
that
got me taken off the air by
that's
TED.
That's right.
The other thing that ayahuasca gives you is this sense of immersion into a seamlessly convincing parallel realm, which is inhabited by intelligent entities. And I've been focusing on Mother Ayahuasca and this tough love that she gives, but this good and loving entity. And again, I need to say, I cannot. And I'm not insisting that this entity is real. Personally, that's how I experience her, and many other do, but she may be a projection of my own mind. I don't know. I can't prove this. What I can say is that the encounters with this entity, if that's what she is, do have definite effects. And the effects are absolutely clear in my case. I gave up a 24-year non-stop cannabis habit that I was deeply committed to. As a result of that encounter. So that's not like a, you know, wishy-washy, oh, my behavior got better. That is actually a huge change that took place in my life as a result of visionary encounters with this entity who sometimes appears as a woman, sometimes appears as a serpent, sometimes appears as a panther or a jaguar. Very, very spooky, but ultimately seems to want the best for us. Now I come to your point. What about demons?
Yeah.
When you open the door to these other realms, if that's what they are. Perhaps they're just inner realms of human subconscious. I can't prove it one way or another. For me, I experience them as real places, as real as another country. When you open the door to these other realms, what you find in there are not only entities that have your best interests at heart. You find other entities, monstrous entities, that are kind of psychic vampires that thrive and live off human misery and fear. Entities like the war god of the Aztecs, like Hummingbird, who seem to relish and enjoy watching his puppets murder human beings. Those kind of entities are out there too, and that's what the job of the shaman is. The job of the shaman is to protect the space and to enable those who are journeying into that parallel realm that the shamans call the spirit world to have as safe a journey as possible and to keep the negative entities back. But every now and then, they do come through. And therefore, it's important to be truthful and to tell the truth completely. And the truth about ayahuasca is that it is not universally beneficial. It is not always a good thing. There's been a recent case in Chile where an individual led a cult based on the consumption of ayahuasca. He is now under arrest for murder. He and his cult sacrificed a baby. They burnt a baby in a fire. This was done under the influence of ayahuasca. And I feel that what happened there was that that person who was leading the cult, who was taking the role of the shaman, was totally motivated by negative forces already. And he invited in the dark side when he went into the other realm and when he took his followers into the other realm. There are shamans in Iquitos in Peru, who use ayahuasca to simply to exploit foreigners. There have been many cases of abusive behavior by shamans towards women, and who've gone there with open hearts and spirits to drink ayahuasca, hopefully to explore their own consciousness, and they end up being raped and exploited by shamans. These things do happen, so it's not all sweetness and light in the garden of ayahuasca. By any means, but I do not blame the brew for that. I do not blame the medicine for that.
Well, exactly. This is about who you are on the inside. There's more to it than that. This is it's a chemistry between the user and what it's experienced as well.
Exactly. That's exactly what's going on. And if you bring negative intent to the experience, then you can invite in these vampiric, these demanding, these hungry ghosts on the other side that seek to exploit human negative energy. And that possibility is always there. And also, what I have found, and I found this recently, in fact, just this year, in a series of ayahuasca sessions that I again attended in Brazil, there was amongst our group, we were a group of 12, there was amongst our group one individual who had extremely negative energy. And I experienced myself being attacked by him in psychic space. Hmm. And I was not the only one in the group who experienced that. And indeed, it turns out that this individual had attacked others in other ayahuasca groups. When you imagine, when you have this experience in the realm of vision, you have to ask yourself, am I imagining it? You know,
sure.
Is it just my fantasy, or am I really being attacked here? And the attack on me, I felt quite confident. You know, I've been drinking ayahuasca for 10 years. I've had 50 plus sessions. I've had a lot of experience in the realms that you go to. I thought I could defend myself against anything. I couldn't defend myself against this guy at all. He just wiped the floor with me. He was like a sort of ninth Dan black belt, and I was like a novice white belt. I just, nothing I could do except for get out of his energy field, get out of the room, get out of the house. I had to get away from him.
Wow.
But what is not imaginary is that he effectively physically assaulted one of the women at the ceremony and placed his hands upon her shoulders and blew into her face. Now, when you know shamanism, particularly Peruvian shamanism, and he had spent time amongst the shamans in Iquitos, you know that the breath is a very powerful thing, and that breath can be used to harm others. and project these psychic darts that are called virotes in the Peruvian tradition. And he made sort of motions with his hands of drawing this woman's energy into his body. It was utterly terrifying experience for her. So I have to say there is a dark side to the ayahuasca phenomenon. The good thing is that thousands, tens of thousands of people all around the world have drunk ayahuasca, and these kind of incidents are actually extremely rare. And most people who've worked with ayahuasca have ended up having very positive and healing experiences. So I'm not trying to put people off ayahuasca. I'm just saying choose your company carefully. Make sure that the shaman is a person of goodwill, who is not attempting to build up a personality cult, who is not drawing in negative forces from beyond the veil, if indeed there is a veil, which I happen to think there is.
Yeah, I agree with you. And there's no one size fits all. It doesn't matter where you turn in the human world and ultimately then beyond as well. But there these type of things always seems to occur. There's no guarantees. And do you think, Graham, that the only way that these demons or the demon, if that's what we're talking about, manage to influence us in the human world and maybe ultimately then change it towards misery, as you kind of alluded to earlier, is this only through people that are in contact, with these entities using these substances, or does happen? No,
I think it happens all the time. I think that this is what shamanism recognizes, that the so-called supernatural realm, which may simply be a huge extension of the natural realm, perhaps we shouldn't use the word supernatural at all, is actually influencing us all the time, whether we like it or not. We just may not be aware of the channels for that influence.
Yeah.
And what the shaman's deliberate induction of an altered state of consciousness does, it allows him or her to engage proactively with those forces rather than simply to be the helpless victim of them. And from the shamanistic point of view, let's not pretend that these things don't exist. Let's rather get to grips with them and deal with them proactively. And the shaman seeks to make himself the master of spirits, not the victim of spirits. And a good shaman can be very powerful and very effective in doing that. But they enter into our lives through dreams. They enter into our lives through that vast realm known as the unconscious. They motivate human behavior in many, many, many ways. Now, of course, again, I repeat, this is only a theory. I can't prove that this is a fact. There may be all kinds of psychological explanations for this, but the fact of human wickedness is a fact. Look at the terrible, terrible things that have been done down the ages in the name of God.
Yeah.
The awful things that still continue to this day, whether it's burning people at the stake or stoning women to death, whether it's the religious wars that take place, the hatred, the fear, the suspicion, the division of us one from another, all in the name of this or that God. And you have to ask yourself, what is really going on here? What is at play? And that's where I find the Gnostic view of the cosmos rather useful, that mankind is the fulcrum of a cosmic struggle between the forces of light and the forces of darkness. And the choices that we make have a huge impact, not only on us, but perhaps on the whole cosmos. So a great burden rests upon our shoulders to choose the right way rather than the wrong way, to seek to do good. And that we should be aware that this is operating in our lives every second, every minute of every day, and that even doing a small harm to another is going to diminish us and them, and that we should be careful how we act to our fellow human beings and how we act to the world, and we should recognize what an incredible opportunity we've been given for learning, for growth, for development, to be born in a human body, to have the chance to make these choices. And we should do our best to make the right choices so that when the end of life comes, it's possible to look back on your life, to look back on the whole course of your life and say, well, yeah, I made mistakes there. I caused pain. I did this and that harm. But ultimately, I tried to put it right. I tried to fix the mistakes I'd made. I tried to be a better person. And when I look back and be able to say, on balance, overall, I did good. That would be the that would be the end life goal, I think, to be able to get to the end. It's difficult to be a perfect angel, you know, sure. every minute of every day.
Yeah.
We're always led down negative paths and lead ourselves down them. But we have a long life. We have the opportunity to learn from our mistakes. If we have caused hurt or pain to others, we don't have to do it again in the future. We don't have to repeat that pattern. We can learn from our mistakes and put things right the next time. That's the opportunity that we have, and I think we should take it.
With our consciousness, if you will, break that that cycle of abuse, if you will. But the nature of this war then that you're talking about of between good and evil, I believe has gone through many different incarnations and updates, if you will, and despite the forces then behind it being potentially, you know, pretty much the same, I think we've been able to see it morph from a physical to a psychic war almost. Tell us about the war on consciousness, Graham.
Well, I think it's a very important part of this struggle of good against evil, of light against dark, is that our society is involved in a largely hidden, incredibly well-funded, extremely potent war on consciousness. Now, let us consider this thing. What is this thing called consciousness? Actually, scientists don't really know what consciousness is. We all know we have it, but we don't really know what it is. There's all kinds of theories. You know, we've got these 3 or 4 pounds of jelly inside our skulls, and we know that in some way they're involved in our consciousness. There's a lot of evidence, not paid much attention to by mainstream science, that our consciousness, even at the level of the body, can't be completely localized to the brain. For example, there's fascinating cases of people who've had heart transplants who start to get the memories of the person whose heart has been transplanted into their body.
Yeah.
You can't explain that if consciousness is purely localized to the brain. You know, when we talk about having a gut feeling, maybe we should take that seriously. As a matter of fact, there are the human gut contains, next to the brain, the largest number of neurons in the human body. So just at a physical level, there's some question marks over the exact nature of the relationship between consciousness and the brain. But going deeper, there is a schism within Western science right now. And that is the schism between what I call materialist reductionist science, which seeks to reduce everything to the realm of matter, and a science that is prepared to consider the possibility that that consciousness itself might be a fundamental force in the universe, and that consciousness may be the original force in the universe, that matter may be a product of consciousness, rather than that consciousness is a product of matter.
Yeah.
So the default view of most orthodox scientists who belong to the materialist faction is that the brain makes consciousness, that the brain manufactures consciousness, that the brain generates consciousness, the way a generator makes electricity. And a scientist asked to defend that view will say, well, of course the brain makes consciousness, because if I damage this or that area of your brain, or if your brain is damaged by some virus or other, it will affect your consciousness. So it's obvious to them that the brain is producing consciousness. If the brain wasn't producing consciousness, then why would damage to the brain affect consciousness? Just seems to be a perfectly obvious point of view to a materialist scientist. But they don't consider the second possibility, which, and again, this was one of the reasons why my TED talk got taken down, because I explored this in the talk, that really consciousness is a mystery, and the relationship of consciousness to the brain could be, to use an analogy, more like the relationship between a TV signal and a TV set. That the TV set is manifesting the signal into a form, but that the signal is not produced by the TV set. So exactly the same argument, you see. If you damage part of a TV set, it will, of course, affect the picture.
That's right.
And if you smash the TV set, the picture will go away completely. But the TV signal is still there, completely unaffected by what you've done to the TV set. And although it goes against the dogma of materialist science, there is, in fact, nothing in any modern scientific research which rules that possibility out. Yes, there's a relationship between consciousness and the brain, but whether the relationship is causal or whether whether in fact the brain is more like some kind of transceiver or receiver of consciousness is something that yet remains to be decided and is not established. But we have this very dogmatic position in science that it is somehow established and that consciousness is just generated by the brain. Well, if you hold that point of view, you can't, of course, believe in spirit worlds. You can't, of course, believe in any life after death. If you hold the view that your consciousness is a product of your brain and nothing else, an epiphenomenon of brain activity, as they call it, then, of course, when your brain dies, that's the end of your story and you're just meat and there's no more you. Your consciousness is gone. So scientist Richard Dawkins is the classic example, ridicule the idea of life after death, and they say it's complete nonsense. And yet, you know, there is so much evidence for life after death. There's the whole phenomenon of reincarnation. Again, they ridicule that, but you know, look at the work of Ian Stevens at the University of Virginia. You know, he went in as a hardline skeptic. He came out looking at the evidence for reincarnation, concluded that the only possible explanation for this evidence was that reincarnation occurred. Well, if reincarnation occurs, then obviously consciousness is not produced by the brain. Obviously, it is incarnating in human bodies down the ages, but is not a product of those bodies. What about telepathy? Many people have the experience of telepathy. My colleague Rupert Sheldrake, his talk was also pulled off the TED YouTube channel.
Yeah, that's right.
At the same time as mine. And Rupert Sheldrake's done, again, because he challenged fundamental dogmas. Rupert Sheldrake's done a lot of work on telepathy and has demonstrated at a level of scientific probability that telepathy does occur. We've all had that experience of knowing when the phone rings, who's on the other end of the line. You know, dogs who know when their owners are coming home, even though in a scientific experiment the owner can be made to change his route and his arrival time at home and return silent, all kinds of things, somehow the dog still knows. Well, this suggests that some kind of connection is taking place at the level of consciousness, which is not localized in the brain, but which exists outside the brain in some way. So I think we have an incredible mystery here. With consciousness. And that now we come to the issue of the war on consciousness. One thing's clear about consciousness. Your consciousness, my consciousness, consciousness of every person listening to this discussion, is their most intimate and personal property. I mean, you know, I've made this point many times, but if our society does not allow us as adults to make sovereign decisions about our own consciousness, then there is no useful sense in which we can be said to be free at all.
That's right, yeah.
Because that is the most fundamental issue for us, yeah. for the human creature. We are consciousness. That is what we are more than anything else. And if we live in a society that seeks to place our consciousness in a prison, or to put it another way, that will in fact put us in prison if we choose to use certain plants, ancient and sacred visionary plants, to explore our consciousness, then we do not live in a free society. And all claims of freedom by that society are bogus and false. This is the fundamental adult right, is to make decisions over our own bodies and our own consciousness. And our society very cleverly, very cunningly, has taken that away. And it does so in the so-called war on drugs, which is not, in fact, of course, a war on drugs at all. It's a war on people. It's a war on the liberty of adults to make choices about their own consciousness, yeah. Cleverly dressed up in the language of a war on drugs. It's not a war on drugs. This is a war on us, on individual citizens of societies whose liberty is at jeopardy if they smoke DMT or drink ayahuasca or take LSD or psilocybin. Let's call this what it is. This is a war on people who have made an adult choice about their own consciousness. Beyond that, our society beams all kinds of messages into our consciousness all the time through television, a very powerful medium for influencing consciousness, through the education system, through the economic system. Our society values and reveres what I call the alert problem-solving state of consciousness, in which we can be good producers and good consumers of material goods. And our society will allow big pharmaceutical companies to make billions of dollars out of consciousness-altering drugs, such as Ritalin or Prozac or Ciroxat.
Yep.
All of these drugs alter consciousness, but they do so in ways that do not threaten the fundamental state of consciousness valued by our society, which is the alert problem-solving state of consciousness. And nor does alcohol. This is the interesting thing. I mean, it's obvious to anybody who looks at the statistics that alcohol is an incredibly dangerous drug. Alcohol causes huge social problems. We can see those social problems on a Saturday night in any city center in Western countries. You can see them in the casualty departments in hospitals, not to speak of the liver damage of long-term alcohol use. I mean, it's a hugely damaging drug. I'm not objecting to people drinking alcohol. As far as I'm concerned, any adult has the right to make any decision about any drug. But if we just look at it in plain terms, alcohol is an incredibly dangerous, damaging, harmful to health drug.
Yeah.
Yet our society glorifies alcohol and allows its promotion and advertising, and one can drink it freely in all kinds of situations. Why? Because, again, it doesn't challenge the fundamental state of consciousness that our society is invested in, which is the alert problem-solving state of consciousness. It's a release from that state of consciousness. It gives us a little sanctioned holiday from that state of consciousness so that we can come back and be more effective producers and consumers the next day, even if we do have a bit of a hangover. So it's clear that there's a regimentation of consciousness in our society, and that certain states of consciousness have actually been criminalized. And can lead to the utter ruin of our lives. Our property can be taken away, our doors battered down, our good name insulted in the press, our liberty taken from us. The complete ruin. We find it difficult to get a job after we've had any conviction for any drugs offense. Completely ruin a person's life. Why? Because that person, as an adult, has made a choice to have a kind of experience with their consciousness that our society doesn't agree with.
Yeah.
And this then the ridiculous thing is that these societies then claim to be champions of freedom and liberty, and they say, look how democratic we are, look how wonderful we are. Not wonderful at all, because they haven't sorted out this basic problem, which is we do not have cognitive liberty in our societies.
It's interesting to me that the few ways that we do have, well, maybe at this stage, because, you know, I believe that human beings have gone through many different kinds of levels of consciousness. And right now we're in a certain set that kind of doesn't allow us to, you know, kind of see behind the veil, as we were talking about earlier. Hence, we need, you know, help in some way. And this, you know, these substances come into the picture in this sense then. But it's interesting that these few ways that we now have to discover the deeper fabric of our reality is being banned, is being taken away, just because, you know, this might be a potential way, I don't know, out of the situation, out of our predicament, you know?
Yes, I think that the thing about the psychedelics is, used responsibly, with proper respect for the power of the medicine, with the correct control of set and setting, and with people of goodwill, they're game changers. They actually change your perception of reality, and they lead to profound and fundamental questions about the way that societies are organized and operate. And what we see in psychedelics is our universal connection to one another as brothers and sisters in the human family. And we lose our intense feeling of support for the nation or for the state. Ideas like patriotism become ridiculous after profound psychedelic experiences. You suddenly realize that you just live in such a much bigger universe than that. You know, who cares what piece of land you happen to have by accident been born on, or what government you were saddled with by the place of your birth? Who cares? Why should you be loyal to that?
Yeah.
What we are is members of a human family. We should be loyal to one another. We should act towards one another with love and care, regardless of what nation or state we belong to. These absurd constructs. And of course, I want to be clear, I'm not here advocating one world government. You know, I'm totally against governments.
Sure,
I detest government. I would like to see as little government as
anarchism.
Yeah, kind of anarchism, actually, yeah. Which literally means without government.
That's right.
And all I see governments doing is causing great harms all around the world.
I agree.
Yeah.
Look at history. I mean, that's all we have to look at. It's the most democide. It's one of the, you know, the ways that the human species have been enslaved most. It's by systems and bureaucracies and by other, you know, human beings, of course, running those systems. But yeah, that's the truth.
And claiming the power and the right to control and order the lives of others.
That's right.
I'd like to see an end to all of that. So I don't want one world government. I want no government at all.
Yeah.
But I want us to live in communities of decent, caring people who look after one another. And I want to dispel the myth that we couldn't do that without the help of governments.
That's right. Well, voluntary. Yeah. We've talked about it so many times on the program. But, you know, voluntarism, that's the way to go. People have to have a voluntary relationship with other people and how they choose to live their lives. Yeah.
Exactly. So it's interesting that governments are massively in the business of consciousness control. And the other institution that is in the business of consciousness control is, of course, the three big monotheistic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. They're also in the business of consciousness control. And they're saying, we are the sole way that you may access the divine. You must do it through us. And if you don't do it through us, by the way, we might kill you. This is also a very sinister factor at work in the world today. So, you know, I can't help feeling that the Gnostic view of things and this struggle of good against evil, that big governments and big religions are deeply implicated on the side of evil.
Why do you think that people are so susceptible to this manipulation and to the subservience? I mean, we're born into it, of course. It's difficult in that way. But how do we get out of that situation, do you think, Graham?
Well, the first step is to take responsibility for yourself. I mean, this is so easy to hand over responsibility to others. It seems easier. It seems more comforting. Reality seems so huge. The world is so threatening. How much easier it is just to hand over our power to others and let them make the decisions for us. But while we do that, we are never going to be fully conscious, fully realized human beings. We have to take over full control of sovereignty, and it starts with our own consciousness. Sovereignty over our own consciousness, that we do not have to believe what we've been told from childhood. What a moronic thing to do, you know. You're born into a certain country or area. You're given a religion and a set of cultural values at childhood, and you're supposed to just believe that that's the only way to do things and that that is absolutely right. How unquestioning is that? You know, the first thing we have to do is question all the structures that have been given to us. Most importantly of all, the religions that we inherited as a child. We need to question those and do not accept the dogma of the priest. Do not accept because it was written in some old book that it is true. Look at what these religions do, not just at what they say. And when we look at what they do and really look at it with clear eyes, we're going to start realizing that there's a whole massive, complex management of reality going on, and we're the victims of that, and we need to stop being victims, and we need to take control of our own lives.
You know, with science disqualifying many of these ideas of a supernatural or something else beyond the material, basically they disqualify those by default. And, you know, into this we can tie, you know, your experiences that you had with Ted and everything else. I see a way out of this, Graham, is for people to simply walk away from these kinds of institutions and try to gain their respect or something like that, trying to fight with the scientific, dogma, what have you.
We have to walk away from it, and I do see that happening. I may sound very pessimistic this evening, but in fact, I'm not pessimistic. I feel very positive. I feel very optimistic. I feel we do live in a blessed universe. And what I do see everywhere, all around the world, is people waking up, particularly young people. It's particularly evident in the youth. And it's particularly evident that new forms of connection are taking place. And this is happening through the internet, that the old systems where we're stuck in a particular culture, a particular nation, a particular patrimony, a particular government, and we'd have no choice, that is now changing, because we have this incredible instrument of liberation called the internet, which is allowing people all over the world who would never before have had contact to exchange ideas in a most fertile manner, and to do so outside the traditional channels which previously have governed human behavior. And so I think a kind of quiet revolution is in the making, that people are waking up all around the world, taking control of their own consciousness and their own sovereignty, and young people everywhere, small numbers as yet, but the numbers are growing, are just refusing to put up with that shit any longer.
Yeah.
That comes down from the controlling dominator powers of society. And something new is being born. Now, it's always unclear when a new thing is taking shape exactly what it's going to end up being. But there again, we are responsible for the world we make. We have choice. That's the one thing that people forget, that we always have choice. Even in the most difficult circumstances, the most challenging, the most terrible circumstances, each and every one of us always has the choice of what we do about ourselves. That choice cannot be taken away from us. The choice is always there.
Very good. Now, and I don't want to, you know, shoot this down here when we're talking about the internet, but I think this is an important point to make because they're moving in that direction now. The war on consciousness, the war on how we share ideas and everything else is continuing. I think David Cameron now recently, today or yesterday maybe, said that by the end of this year, when someone sets up a new broadband account, the settings to install family-friendly filters will be automatically selected. Meaning that the UK is now looking at, well, they're going up for the anti-pornography angle here, but the plan is to obviously censor the internet. So the nature
plan,
of the
plan
fight.
Is to censor the internet, and they very cleverly used an issue which has great emotional power in order to mount that assault. What is at the heart of this assault is pure censorship of the internet. And governments, of course, are terrified of the internet because it deprives them of their power.
Yeah, that's right. And it shows also that the nature of this fight is continuing, I guess, when there are different technologies coming to our disposal or things that we, modalities that we can use to you know, share our thoughts and ideas, that these will be tried to be limited. But I don't, you know, to be honest, I don't think that they will ever be able to pull this off because there's so many talented people out there that will have setting up their own networks if necessary and just continue it. There's no way.
I think it's important to recognize, you know, that the internet is like ayahuasca. The internet is used for negative things sometimes, for very bad things, and that this again is where the responsibility of the free and sovereign adult comes into play. Because we do not have to choose wicked and negative aspects of the internet. We can choose ourselves not to accept those wicked and negative aspects. We do not need government to make those choices for us. The choice is useless if it's made for us by a government by default without any say-so of our own. We need to make those choices ourselves. Only in that way can we become better people and make the world a better place. So any government action which removes choice from individual sovereign adults and invests it in government power is actually deeply negative in its consequences.
Yeah, I mean, if we decide to censor, you know, to be able to protect us, if you will, from the bad things, and if that's at the cost of you know, ruining the good things that we do have access to, then we're making a big mistake. And I think
a huge mistake. Yeah. And also the abusive and exploitative and cruel, horrific images on the internet, the right way to deal with those is for people to choose not to indulge in them.
Well, that's
not
right.
not to be controlled by a government into making that choice. People need to take the adult responsibility over that choice themselves.
Well, exactly. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think we have to get over this idea that things in the world are, that we will manage to live in this kind of protective bubble where nothing that is offensive or nothing that is hurtful will ever, you know, come into our space, if you will. I think that we are doing ourselves ultimately a disservice by having that approach and even you know, raising
terrible,
our children that way.
Actually, terrible, you know? Terrible disservice. And the governments that are seeking to control us in this way are the very governments that are dividing us with hatred and fear and suspicion, that are investing in technology like drones, you know, which can wipe out entire villages from the sky remotely, that have caused so many wars and so much division amongst human beings for so long. Why should we trust a single word these governments say?
Yeah, well, you can't see a nude breast on a statue, you know, but it's okay. It's okay to exactly develop technologies that murder hundreds at a time. No problem.
Exactly. The big pornography is the pornography of government behavior.
That's right.
That's the real pornography. That's the real terrorism. You know, we need to open our eyes on this and see the truth.
Well, very well said, Graham. Before we wrap things up here for this time, then I want you to give, you know, I want to give you the opportunity to mention your websites and the book again, but also tell us what's next for you. Then you said to follow up to the Fingerprints of the Gods, yeah, it's in the works.
Yeah, I'm big into writing novels right now, I am going to do another nonfiction book, and that is going to be a sequel to Fingerprints of the Gods. There's fascinating new evidence which supports the case for a lost civilization. We could have a whole other discussion about that, which would last us another hour and a half. But the new evidence has convinced me that there's that what had become a bit of a cold case, the cold case for a lost civilization, is urgently in need of reopening. And I'm going to reopen that case, and I'm going to present a big book to the public that I'll be writing during 2014, which presents this new evidence that was not there when I wrote Fingerprints of the Gods.
Interesting. Well, that sounds fascinating. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. And again, an appeal for an appeal for help. Give my fiction a try. You know, have a look at it. Don't just dismiss it and say, like the publishing industry wants to say, you know, Hancock is just a nonfiction author and there's no point in looking at his fiction. Have a look at it. And the website for the new novel is war-god.com. And my own website is grahamhancock.com. And on both of them, you'll find chapters from the novel and background articles about the novel. So you can check it out and see whether it's something you might want to pay some attention to.
Very good. We'll have the links up on redicecreations.com. Thank you so much, Graham. We'd love to have you back, of course, and talk more when your follow-up is out due or before that, of course, because it's a while off until then. But yeah,
it's a while off. I'll look forward to the next time. Been very nice to talk to you.
Thank you so much. Keep up your good work, Graham.
Thank you.
And that concludes our program with Graham Hancock for this time. A big thanks to all our members and to everyone working hard at keeping Red Eyes going. I hope you have a great rest of your day and a good start to your week. We'll be back on Wednesday with Ken Rolla. I'm going to talk about Ormesite and Scalar Technologies, both for healing and for free energy. That's an interesting one, so don't miss that one. Later we have Scott Onstock, Suzanne Posel, and David Icke as well. So stay healthy, stay strong, and have a good rest of your day. Bye-bye.